I think there's really, really few people in the world that have a deep understanding of what's happening with AI and how quickly things are accelerating, and also what's happening with Bitcoin and how quickly things are accelerating there. And I think there's really a need. I've been asked by a couple of people that I respect from both fields to think more about this synthesis between what happens in a world where capital goes fully digital, I think on the Bitcoin network, and labor potentially is useless, which I think is like hyperbolic. But I don't know. I think that's something we could talk on for years to come. But it's like shockingly, there's almost no one in the world that understands both, is what I'm saying.
Are there areas within AI outside of payments? Like, let's say that Bitcoin and the payment part of Bitcoin ultimately works and scales. Are there things within AI that you think still kind of require cryptographic certainties that we can't get? Like, is it mostly a payment problem when you see AI and crypto converging, or is there something else within AI around like certainty of which model was used or something like that, where you think?
Well, actually, I think the answers are both. I mean, I actually was thinking more sort of societal, more like sort of new socioeconomic landscapes. I do think, to your point, one of the things, you're just going to get a bunch of my big things out at the front. One of the things that I think is going to make a Noster in particular pop this year is just cryptographic certainty, like the fact that every node is signed with a private key. I think people are going to be just absolutely shocked at how quickly dead internet theory goes through the roof. I think dead internet theory, for those of you who don't know, this was announced on 4chan or 8chan, one of the chans many years ago. But the idea that whoever you're interacting with on the internet is not a human, but a bot. I think we probably are already at that point. Maybe last year crossed it. I think this year is the year that like, everyone starts to realize, oh my God, everything is fake. The fact that a Stacker News item I saw, Zuckerberg is going to start having, you know, more AI-generated bots interacting with you on Facebook and Instagram. I mean, that could be cool, but like 99% chance is going to be extremely dystopian, probably going to be used to tune people to make them think like, hey, the stuff that I'm sharing is actually interesting, even my friends don't. Anyway, so I think cryptographic proving it's coming from you, a human, web of trust, that's going to be extremely important. That's its own sort of set of topics. But what I was actually thinking of is something much more, you know, from the sort of like sociologist perspective, which is, you know, in the article that Steve sent, which was spawned by the Elon tweet that money is going to become useless after AI. And then Steve shared a good piece from Lessrum, or some post there talking about actually, no, whoever holds the capital at the time of AI going, whatever, they're going to be able to buy anything because, you know, they're going to have all the capital. I actually don't think it's at all clear what's going to happen there. And I think I can paint many different pathways. But what I do know is that if all capital, or let's say at least 50% of global capital today, probably more, accrues to the Bitcoin network, and at the same time, the value of labor goes, at least in the short term, to zero, I think that those two singularities hitting together, that's why I'm saying that almost no one's thought with those two, what the societal impacts of. Does it literally just mean those that hold a lot of Bitcoin are feudal kings and that's going to last forever? Does that eventually get disrupted? Does the fact that, you know, there's still scarcity in the economy, but the scarcity is attention, does that lead to, you know, just new markets that created and actually allow for people that don't have capital to be even more important? I think these are all very fascinating and like open possibilities.
Yeah. And the scarcity of attention itself may go away if like we actually have bots that are interacting with us, liking our posts and commenting. Like, who's to say that not everybody is just sort of interacting with bots and there's really no scarcity of attention, but it's really scarcity of trust? Because I think the one thing that I need to navigate the world is to be able to know who I can go to for what signals, how I can learn about things and verify data. And I just don't have enough information to do all the verification myself at all times. So I kind of have to rely on trust of people and voices and nodes. And that trust thing is, I think, what Nostra can help with. Because you can say this note was signed as a private signature, you know, private key signed this thing. So I trust it came from the same node that was, you know, mentioning these other things that I've come to believe are sort of correct and truly presented. I think go ahead.
Well, I would take a step back there. I mean, there's so many different interesting areas that opens up the possibilities for it, and I think each are worth exploring. But I would like to come back to this idea. Yes, trust is going to be very, very important. And so this is something that we've all talked about in the past. DK and I have jammed on Nostra News in the past about the web of trust and Nostra being one of the reasons I'm so bullish on. For those of you who aren't aware of that, you know, you can Google Web of Trust. You know, it's an old cypherpunk idea, pre-Bitcoin idea as well. you know, PGP keys. There's this whole idea of if you have a public key, that's your identity. You sign everything with a private key. And from that, you can have an emergent web of trust instead of relying on trust from a central party like a Facebook, like a US government would. And so that, I believe, Nostr fulfills the promise of what PGP did, because we already have way more people with Nostr keys than ever had PGP keys. So I think that's really, really exciting possibility. But I do want to come back to your other point on attention. I hear you, and I think those are both scarcities, reputation and trust and attention. But I still think that, you know, when you think about what markets are useful to allocate when there's a scarcity. And if there's no scarcity in anything at all, then all the AGI heads are right. And we can go like peace and love and all that good stuff. But I think that's impossible, because just by nature of existence, maybe you could say the one source is infinite at all times. But if you want to exist in reality in any way, shape, or form, you have to have constraints. And so till I see something radically different, I believe there's going to be constraints. I come back to the one fundamental constraint for me always is still attention. Because even in that world, you talk about trust is scarce and it's a very valuable resource, but there is still, call it root attention or base attention, which is I as a human, even if I have a trillion bots analyzing 10 trillion pieces of information every second, there's still only what I can focus on moment by moment and see. And I, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this. Maybe a paper will be dropping this year, but I think it's a strange and interesting synchronicity that, you know, the people that created all this AGI hype, in fact, already told you, I think very early on at the beginning of this revolution, where the scarce markets be, with the seminal paper itself, attention is all you need. Attention is always and everywhere. Humans, bots, all around.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, we have so far managed to exclude Steve from the conversation because Bitcoin has not been mentioned once yet.
Well, one thing I'll say, you said that this year, we'll start to see, it'll become very commonplace to not really know if you're interacting with bots or not, or maybe you know, but you are interacting with bots. So interestingly enough, I posted on X what topics people would like to cover on our episode today. And I got a bot replying to me with a topic idea.
Did it have a good idea?
Not really.
I mean, if it were a good idea, I'd be impressed.
This is... let's dive into the ETF circus and what it means for Bitcoin price discovery. Or we could talk about how base ETH is absolutely crushing it with those gas fees. Your call, but I'm ready to get technical as fuck.
I'm sure that Steve is just chomping at the bit to talk about the base fees on Ethereum. Let's just have a moment and let you rip on that.
Yeah. This is really a call to action for humans to respond. If you're listening, what topics would you like us to talk about? We've got some
expertly
topics.
Expertly transitioned.
We're very interested in what you want to hear about. So feel free to join our live chat or post on.
Yeah. Thanks for the mention. Yeah, we should have mentioned that. Please do chime in and let us know. We let Max rip at the beginning because he was just so excited. But I had actually a beginner that I wanted, a lead that I wanted to drop, which is happy 16th anniversary of the Bitcoin network. Yeah.
Genesis block. Right.
Genesis block.
I like, and Bitcoin has like three birthdays, right? There's the white paper drop.
Yep.
There's the, hey, Connor. There's the Genesis block. And then there's like the first actual block mined.
And so I think the white paper drop was it October 31st, 2008?
Halloween.
And then today is Jan 3rd, and then is the next one Jan 9th or something?
I believe that's correct.
And there was a thing that I don't think I fully understood when I was first learning about Bitcoin. I didn't understand how important that inscription, I shouldn't use the word inscription, but how important the words that were written into the block meant. I thought it was just kind of like a little bit of like promoting the ideology or propaganda, but it actually served a very useful purpose around, you know, ensuring people understand the neutrality of Bitcoin. Do you want to share about that, Steve?
Well, it's possible for someone who creates a new money to, the term is pre-mined, but the idea is that you create a bunch for yourself ahead of making it public information or sharing it with the world. So Satoshi wanted to prove that he had not done that. So in the Genesis block, he included a headline from that day's paper, which couldn't have occurred prior to that day. So it proved that Genesis block was really that. Was it?
And then what were the mechanics? Like he put it out. He was presumably then mining on his own computer just to try to get the network going. And then what was the significance of the like somewhat later date, like Gen 9th or whatever I think it was? That was that enough of the initial proof of work had been done that it was like, were there like six confirmations or something like that? Or what was sort of the significance at that point?
I don't know if we know why it took 6 days, but the Genesis block, the one that was produced on January 3rd, is special. You can't spend the Bitcoin that was in the Coinbase of the Genesis block. So every other block after that is sort of the same format, same rules, but the Genesis block is special. I don't know if there's like even, I don't know what the speculation is or if we know anything about why there was a 6 day pause, maybe still tweaking the code, the network, who knows. But the block on January 9th, block one, which was the second block, that was the first one that was produced from running the Bitcoin software.
Do we know when the first transaction part of that, or was there a transaction a few blocks in, or it's not really well known? I guess we can research it, but
it's known. It's like block, I don't know, 170 or something like that.
Oh, really? So they were just sitting there mining and not even transacting. I guess there probably weren't good enough tools like wallets and stuff to even like play with, right? We barely got the thing up and going.
Then Satoshi's sending itself at that point.
Right. Block, yeah, 170?
Yeah.
Okay. That's correct. According to ChatGPT.
All right.
So I'd also like to maybe pause on the Genesis block and maybe some of the philosophy there as well, because, you know, I mentioned this to you guys in the chat. I think maybe one really nice way to start off the new year would be to chat a little bit about why we're all so excited about Bitcoin and why we're all putting so much time into this. Obviously, for those who don't know, we don't have to rehash all of this. It's well known at this point, but that message that Steve was referencing, it wasn't just a timestamp. It also says Chancellor on the brink. For anyone who's not familiar, there, long, and it's been a whole episode just talking about moral hazards to try to prevent the empiric money from sapping the energy of people that have to work for money versus those that have to print. They're able to print, et cetera. I think there's a lot there. But one thing that I would just comment, and I'm curious, you know, folks in the chat, maybe you have had similar experiences. It's really kind of unfortunate to me that I've seen in my own life and just, you know, with people I interact with, that Bitcoin has gotten lumped in largely with one of two things. You know, it's the crypto scamminess, which is its own, you know, can of worms. Bitcoiners don't really consider themselves part of that. And then there's, you know, a lot of people that I think maybe see
a better understanding of base reality in order to be able to do those kinds of things in the most efficient way and that benefit the most number of people. So I see Bitcoin as just money as just like the first problem to solve on this like multi-layered, like why does civilization work the way it does? Why is society organized the way it does? Why do corporations organize the way they do? All of that can only work if you have an incorruptible foundation. For me, that's what's like, so that's why I like to spend a lot of my time figuring out how does Bitcoin is sort of the message and the truth of Bitcoin. How do we bridge that into the traditional tech builder space? Because it's like a very confusing transition for a lot of people. A lot of people don't know about it, don't understand it. And I think if I can help usher some of that transition or be some of that bridge to the truth of Bitcoin, to the truth of how we build new technologies and how we get technologies to benefit more people, then I would to me, that's a life's work. That's a mission that I find worth pursuing, worth spending my time on.
Good.
That's great. Great answer. I also adopt that answer.
Yeah.
To work on Bitcoin.
I love it too. Yeah. I mean, I share a lot of those views as well. And I would say my reasons for why Bitcoin have grown, I would say evolved over the years. I think evolution is actually a really key element for me in all of this. The first thing though, I would say, similar to you guys, read it about Bitcoin early on and completely forgot about it. And then I came back in through originally Ethereum and decentralized energy trading before coming all in. And that was during, you know, the last, so let's say 2016, 2017 stuff. For me, I think the kind of like three stages of my understanding, in addition to obviously, you know, this is an incredible allocation of capital, which I think number go up is necessary. It's like all of the sort of beautiful incentive alignment and all pro-social behavior that Bitcoin promotes. I do think it's a kind of alchemy. Takes selfishness or self-interest of individual actors or agents and literally transmutes it into cooperation. So I think you need both pieces. I think the cooperation piece doesn't work unless you recognize that agents, most, the vast majority of agents are self-maximizing. That's right. And that's the beauty of Bitcoin, is that by taking this capital, storing this capital, contributing back to the whole ecosystem, you help advance all the beautiful things DK has mentioned and more. This says, oh yeah, you guys just like get rich quick, which is funny because I know it's nothing but quick and it's nothing easy. I don't know. I just think it'd be maybe really nice to try and dance again, Steve, you chatted last week, how you were explaining to it, you know, some of the basics around custody and things like that. How would you describe to someone briefly why you were so passionate about Bitcoin? Hey, each of you dedicated, particularly Steve, you the last 10 years full-time, DK, you a tremendous amount of time as well to Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's a great topic. I'll start. Yeah, I think in 2013 is when I learned about Bitcoin, read the white paper, sort of understood it at a very superficial level. But then sort of like set it aside and moved on with life. I was working at Google. Fast forward to January 2017. That's really the moment when I started focusing on cryptocurrency full time. And in January 2017, I would not have called myself a Bitcoiner or someone exclusively interested and focused on Bitcoin. In fact, January 2017 is when I learned of Ethereum, and like any good Silicon Valley tech person, I was enamored by World Supercomputer and this explosive application environment and all the devs that are focused on it and the cool, you know, that you could build full-blown applications on this blockchain. So it was then when I really started studying the space full-time. And the reason I didn't really get Bitcoin super well at that point is I didn't really have an appreciation for the history of money. And so 2017 is when I started studying the history of money more. Up until that point, money worked well for me. Like, I had a good job at Google, made good money, and didn't really have problems with money. So I just had this like basic, you want more money, but money is good, you want money. But I didn't understand the history. So 2017, I much better understood the history of money, the problems with money around the world, especially if you get outside the United States. And developed a better appreciation for gold and its place in the history of money. Prior to that, I had the Warren Buffett view of like gold is a horrible investment, it's a non-productive asset. I didn't really get it. It just seemed like a shiny rock. 2017, I gained an appreciation for that. But then, you know, 100x that, I gained appreciation for what Bitcoin could become. And not, you know, not only a great store of value, but also as a currency. And the last part, coin as a currency, is why 7-8 years later, I'm still working on Bitcoin. If I only thought Bitcoin was store of value, end of story, then I'd consider it a phenomenal investment and invest. And then I'd go work on AI or work on some other interesting software or tech problem. But I think for store of value, Bitcoin, the product's sort of already done. There's product market fit. It's largely just a matter of creating awareness, improving like self-custody tools, things like that. For currency, there's a lot of software development that still needs to be done. A lot of R&D, a lot of design, user experience work. So there's a lot of stuff that matches sort of my skill set, people that I work with skill set. So I feel like we can really have an impact, increase the chance. It's not a foregone conclusion Bitcoin will be a currency. So I feel like my work, my team's work, the people, you know, all the open source colleagues I work with, we can make a difference and help turn Bitcoin into currency. So that's why I work on it. But why is Bitcoin being a currency important for the world? You know, I think it's inevitable that the world shifts to digital money. Like, throughout my lifetime, we've gone from no one using digital money to, like, you know, the vast majority of people around the world use, at least in the Western world, and throughout Asia. I mean, a lot of people in the world use digital money, and they use digital money for all kinds of reasons. It's like convenient, and there's you know, it's frictionless until it's not. But a huge shift is with paper money or coins or the money that humans have used for centuries and millennia. You know, you can transact with someone, just you and the other person. Like, if you go to a farmer's market and you want to buy a good from someone, you hand them a $20 bill. You get the good, you're done with that transaction. And with digital money, there's always a middleman, someone in the middle to you know, that can block the payment, ban you. And with the rise of AI, I think that's going to get even more challenging. And so with the huge innovation of Bitcoin is that you can have digital money that behaves like cash. So I worry about a future in which we don't have that as a solution. It's a very dystopian future in which millions or billions of people could be at the mercy of one person just pressing a button and being able to curtail how they spend their money, what it can be used for, or even use their money at all. And we already see that with like social credit scores in China, where if like your cousin says the wrong thing about the wrong, you know, or a certain person, you can be cut off from the subway system or buying food, or, you know, that's a very dystopian future. So developing a tool that can resist that, I think, is very, very important for human society.
Cool. And I can give my answer, but before I do that, I want to actually ask Steve a little bit about his answer. And this is a theme or sort of a question we posed at the end of one episode before, but I'm curious because you mentioned sort of about how important payments is. I can understand that that's pretty important to you. And I think a lot of people would say, look at the rise in the volume of stablecoin usage. And in a sense, stablecoin usage is sort of an alternative to native Bitcoin payments. So is stablecoin usage, is that in a sense part of the promise of what you were hoping could be achieved? Or is it sort of antithetical because of the control points and the centralization points present? Are you sort of a fan that they are demonstrating, some flavors of this to the world? Or do you think they are ultimately leading people down kind of confusing path?
Neither, really. I mean, one thing's for certain, it doesn't solve the problem I just mentioned, that, like, censorship resistance, or like digital cash, basically. Digital money that has cash-like properties, that is not any US dollar or any fiat currency stablecoin, because there's middlemen. There's people in the middle, whether it be issuers or there's software intermediaries involved. So it doesn't solve that problem. But having said that, I don't think it's bad. I mean, I think there's a lot of people around the world that can lead a better life if they have access to dollars. And this can afford them that, at least until someone decides that they don't want them to have access to those dollars. But I think it's like a good thing, but it's a different thing. It's orthogonal to Bitcoin. And then, is it a competitor Bitcoin? Does it crowd it out? I don't think so. Arguably it will, just like altcoins, I think, are net positive for Bitcoin. It just introduces more people to the general concepts and the, digital money. And a lot of people who start with an altcoin learn over time. They get it, starts a journey, they go on a journey, and they learn over time that Bitcoin is like more sustainable. I think the same thing can happen with stablecoins. Bitcoin stands in its own right because it still has unique properties like censorship resistance and a finite number of, the supply schedule is known. So if those things matter for the world, then Bitcoin's still gonna win, still gonna matter. If those things don't matter for the world, which I find a little strange that they wouldn't matter for the world, but if they don't, well then great, people keep using stablecoins. The other issue with stablecoins is it's US centric, right? I'm not aware of any other currencies that are really that popular stablecoins. It's pretty much US dollars. So it might be a phenomenal way for the United States to just continue to exert its power around the world. But does the rest of the world like that?
Okay. Well, I can give a bit of my kind of, why I got into Bitcoin and sort of why I'm interested in contributing to its success. So, I sort of have a similar timeline to Steve, sort of learned about Bitcoin, quite a while ago, but ultimately, or initially kind of dismissed it because the digital gold narrative did not really appeal to me. I was maybe more of the, like, what can be built? What kind of interesting things can be built around it? If it's just gold, it's just a marker of value. It's, we have gold, we have other things, like, it didn't seem to matter that much to me. But I do think that the narrative of like, oh, world computer, you can build all kinds of stuff with these cryptocurrencies. I think that was initially what got me like very excited to actually spend a lot more time in mental cycles trying to understand what these things are all about. And, I sort of spent a bunch of time in that era and ultimately recognized that Bitcoin is very different. It has very different properties than any of the other stuff. And that all of the like potential building that we wanted to do or would imagine could be done was not actually very sustainable or durable types of things. Like we're here, we are, Steve mentioned 2017 of January. Here we are, January 2025. And it's hard to say that there's an on-chain application that really matters. There's, you know, and so it's say, hey, let's give another 10 years. Like maybe that's what we need. But I think ultimately, like most of the applications that claim to be cryptocurrency related are actually payment related. And Bitcoin is a better payment mechanism than any of the other ones, or let's say is a better money mechanism. And payments is one feature of money that maybe we don't have fully solved yet. But it's hard to imagine that you can replace other features of, like, just get payment side right and screw up the, you know, the limited supply or kind of neutrality. So I sort of went through that similar kind of up and down with it and got very excited about Bitcoin because I started to understand how neutral it was. And that's really what matters to me is I almost feel like, I think I was initially attracted to a lot of it, the hype. A lot of it was created by, you know, the number go up stuff. And I had already made money at this point. I was not trying to like get rich on Bitcoin, but I was like, oh, like I should allocate appropriately. Like I should allocate in a way that is, you know, recognizes the future and participates in the future. So it wasn't about like Bitcoin could be this get rich quick scheme, but it's more like this is a smart allocation of capital. And then I kind of started realizing, oh, like, anything else is actually kind of a dumb allocation of capital. Like it kind of flipped for me that nothing really looked good compared to the neutrality of Bitcoin. And so the thing that I said, like the Chancellor on the Brink, the timestamp, the no pre-mining, all of those things were pretty, you know, like the way mining and the network and who gets to do what and how nobody needs anybody else's permission. Those kinds of things seem to me like such a fundamental new idea, and we just have no way to implement it before we have this. So I think about like the way, you know, the way any corporation or government works, it's almost all like who you're close to, who do you know, who likes you. It's all this like human favoritism in a sense, like, which is like kind of natural. Just people like to do stuff with people they like to do stuff with. It's fine. But it also means that every one of these institutions has this like layer of untruth or kind of these control points, these points where people sort of use their position to enforce their will on others instead of a system where you get a lot more neutrality because everything is clear. And so when I look at Bitcoin, maybe I was initially saying, oh, number go up, a smart allocation. But I think what I came to believe about it is that it's the only like foundation of truth that we have is like, we know that this mining happened. We know that this block reward went to this person or to this, you know, address, and we can know things about it at the fundamental that then let us build better things on top of it. And it's better things are often going to be payment related stuff, I think is the right thing to be looking for. But we could rebuild, what is a corporation? How does it function? You know, I think the things that we hear about with Doge trying to make changes to slim down the US government, that is the same thing that Bitcoin is in my mind. It's a reflection of the same desire, which is how do we get the kind of political, social kind of favoritism out? And how do we get to base layer of what is reality and why do people act the way they act? And to me, Bitcoin is all about like base layer of reality. Like this is why people choose to collaborate and gather around this system that nobody controls is because we may not all agree with each other. We may not like each other, but we opt in to cooperate in this way because it helps us collaborate and achieve more. And I think that can be a great foundation for better government and great foundation for building better technologies, making, you know, you want to send rockets to the stars. Like I think you need.
So I think that's an important point to note. Second thing I'll note for me is it starts with, and I think this is where I start when I try and explain this to noobs or people that are maybe coming out of the world and saying crypto, you guys are all Sam Bankman-Fried. Gross. And I get it. It really does look disgusting from the outside. The first thing that I try and explain, though, is, you know, you could tell someone to go and read all of this economic theory and try and understand all these civilization pieces, but it's so complex. And, you know, we could spend many podcasts and not go through all of it. The first thing I try and understand is just some basis of fairness. And when I was going deep down my rabbit hole, similar timeline with you, Steve, I was not. all his student of the history of money or gold or any of that. I also thought the gold bugs were kind of weirdos from the South. So I know a lot of them. All right, here comes some guys with their guns. Here we go. I still kind of feel that way, to be honest. But, you know, it's fairness and this idea that, you know, in any system, there's only one currency that matters, which is energy. That's a theme that comes back to me over and over again, given that I'm coming out of the energy industry. And so you know, I try and explain to people, you as a quote unquote normal person, a pleb, so to speak, have to work for your meal, right? Like you have to expend energy and get some store of energy back, which is now there are other people, the people that control the money printer that don't have to work for their money. They can literally just print it out of it. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying things a bit, but there was a piece I read back in 2017 by this guy who I imagine it was a pseudonym, but a disillusioned banker or some sort of crypto Izzy called the Masters. They just laid it out to me. It's like, imagine money is leaves and there are like, you know, in a population of 10,000, one or two people that can go and point to which leaves get to be used as money. If you're one of the, you know, the suckers that has to work for their leaves and these guys can go just point thin air. All of a sudden, what they're really doing is robbing you of life force because you have to run faster and faster on a treadmill to earn your keep to be able to put food on the table while those who are in the know are basically pulling a giant scam on you. And I can't help but always thinking of, you know, the photo of, I think it's George Bush Sr., all the guys laughing like that. That to me, it's like, you know, not fully conspiracy. I think this just, like you said, happens naturally. You do things with your friends. I don't think it's necessarily evil. It's just that the incentives and the technology systems were aligned and broken in such a way that, yeah, you would be dumb not to play this game, you know? And I think this is kind of like the ring of the Lord of the Rings. If you have this ability to create value out of thin air and devalue the work of everyone else that's having to work for their food on the table, of course you would. And I think almost anyone would do that, save for maybe some very special souls like a Satoshi. And so anyhow, once you start explaining to people that, the one way I think about it is it's a form, what we have today, of invisible slavery. It's a form of vampirism because the ability to just print out of thin air and have people work for the monopoly money that you can create is literally a way of keeping people in chains, right?
What is that word, vampirism?
Yeah, basically like a vampire gets their life source by sucking the air.
Oh, vampirism. Got it.
Vampirism, vampirism.
Yep. Got it.
And so that to me was a very powerful analogy. And then I try and explain to people, you know, I said, have you seen The Big Short? And people are like, maybe they're like, cool. Well, remember how, you know, these banks, you know, I try and say then the next kind of really cynical, sinister thing that happened is, you know, blaming capitalism for all the ills of the world. It's like, it's like one of these things where you almost say it's very Orwellian, white is black. And the way I try and explain to people is our current system has nothing to do with freedom. I mean, very little to do with free markets. That our current system is in fact a form of socialism, but it's a socialism where the gains are privatized, but the losses are social. Privatize the gains, socialize the losses. And so when I explain to people, you know, when people took really irresponsible loans, remember strippers getting five houses in the Michael Lewis book? And then I wonder what's going to happen there. Then things blow up and the taxpayer ends up bailing them out. And all of a sudden, if you owned a home or a capital asset in that world, you're fine. And if you didn't, well, you're unable to pay. And that's kind of like the extreme social unrest we've mentioned. Anyways, all that to say that it's a lot and it's hard to explain that to everyone. But I think this idea of just fairness, like it's unfair that some have to use their labor or their creativity and others can literally just make something out of politics to benefit. So I think that's something that everyone can understand, that there's kind of very noble intentions here if this works. Not to mention your point, Steve, this is beyond US centric. It's far worse for people outside of the US where we export our inflation. And for me, living in Mexico for 5 years, I saw a lot of that with Argentinian friends, Venezuelan friends, and even Mexican friends, sort of up close and personal. So that's number one. The second thing, though, is a much more positive outlook, which is like, yes, I think starting from a place that this is a better, more fair, just system for 8 billion humans is fantastic. The next thing I think about is, you know, as someone that, for me, part of the reason I love technology and investing in all this is I love just understanding what's possible within the realm of physics of what can come next. To your point, DK, Bitcoin is a realm of base truth. And the reason it's a realm of base truth is because it gives us the best establishment we have. And this is something I'm riffing on a little bit newly. Another sort of essay is germinating here. The two most metrics we have about our physical reality, which are energy and information. And so Bitcoin to date is the most pure energy-backed money we ever have. Gold was the closest thing we had to energy-backed money because you had to expend energy, you had to dig it up. Of course, over time, if we're able to create new gold or mine it from asteroids, that becomes much less useful. But that's the reason gold, you know, was the shelling point for value. It's energy backed money. Bitcoin is pure energy backed money. So again, I say this, you know, I feel like on every other show, but hash rate and cost for creation of coin are the only metrics that I really care about when I look at Bitcoin. That's number one. Information. Why are free markets so beautiful? Well, free markets are beautiful because they can take infinite inputs and put it into this one piece of information, which is a price. But if the price gets distorted because the money is completely made up, you know, monopoly money, then prices, the information of how a system can collaborate and cooperate is completely blown out. Now, I want to throw the caveat, markets and information are beautiful. They're truly beautiful, but they're not the only way that humans can collaborate. And I understand there's still always room for pure altruism. I think that's its own topic. The reality is, at least at a 8 billion plus scale, information on markets are the best thing we have. But at hyperlocal scales, I think altruism and more socialist mechanisms work really well. Separate conversation. But then when you say, okay, if we've had this vampiric leaky money that does not reflect true information, no wonder we're having trouble evolve. No wonder shit's gone off the rails since the fuck happened in 1971. You know, great website. I always tell people to start down with this journey as well. So then the thing that gets me excited is, to your point, DK, and I think this is something that the three of us hopefully can really contribute to, because to your point, Steve, we're not, you know, certain this is going to become a panacea, is, you know, how do we get the builders in Silicon Valley who maybe don't appreciate all the other stuff that we talked about through? Once you have a better foundational model, reality with energy and information, you can then begin to build sustainable new layers on top of our civilization. And to me, the thing that gets then most exciting is once you have energy-backed money moving at the speed of light. And by the way, it just clicked for me. I had a moment, a eureka at the sauna a couple days ago with Block, calling your LSP C equals. Not yours. Steve has nothing to do with it. But he checked me. I was like, it's a beautiful name. Money moving at the speed of light for the first time ever. Holy fuck. And now that we have pure value and information moving at the speed of light, when we develop those next layers on top of civilization, which I think, as someone called out at the very beginning, Connor, AI agents plus lightning, I still believe fully, and this is where I'm, you know, investing most heavily. You guys don't even know this, but my most recent investment was thinking more about payment infrastructure for agents. You know, you cannot build a fair world of the next life form participating in markets without fair money, without fair payment systems that operate at the speed of light. So if we want, and I think AI is inevitable, if we want this next realm of evolution, human and otherwise, to be sustainable, fair, prosperous, exciting, I think Bitcoin and payment networks that make Bitcoin necessary are not only a good thing, they're absolutely are not only exciting, they are absolutely necessary. And so it's a long-winded answer, but I think if we want to evolve, this is what we need.
I just wanted to add to what you just said. You're saying money moving at the speed of light. Some of the audience might say, we already had that. You know, if you use like a credit card or debit card, you can pay someone, you know, around the world. But what's critical to understand about the Lightning Network and Bitcoin is that it's settling the payment in 1 second. It's not a credit system. There's no trusted intermediary. It's actually settling. You are transferring money and it's settling in 1 second, which is unprecedented and super cool.
And for people who missed the Eureka, I don't know if you can share whose Eureka this was, Steve, originally, but Block's LSP, Lightning Service Provider, is called C equals. And I knew, oh, that has something to do with all this, but I never really paused and fucked. I was like, yeah, E equals MC squared, where C is the constant for the speed of light, which has many other implications, but really, really nice name.
Yep. Cool. I was just catching up with a friend a couple days ago, kind of in the new year, and he was asking about what I'm up to. And I mentioned that we were doing this live stream, and he's kind of like been aware of Bitcoin, never really got involved. You know, he's a beneficiary of all the existing financial ecosystem. And I think a lot of times people don't understand how much they're on the side of the oppressed versus the oppressor. Like if you have access to like cheap credit and mortgages and, you know, first world financial services stuff, you know, you actually have, you're on the winning side of the current system. And he's definitely on the winning side. He's kind of like, I don't know. I don't really get it. Like, shouldn't this all work itself out? Like, you know, if I have an asset that goes up by 5%, and if, you know, if eggs increase cost by 5%, then all fine. Why do we need this other stuff? Like, it all just kind of works itself out in the free market. In a case like that, would you would you try to add some color, or would you try to explain why you should still be considering Bitcoin, or would you kind of say, yeah, you're probably right, it'll all work out, markets are efficient?
Well, I mean, one thing you could say is that maybe the system works for you, I mean, but not a lot of other people. And if there's a recognition of that, then it could still be worth their time either investing in it or understanding it.
I think maybe it's a bit more out there, but also what we were just discussing, which, you know, there's the moral argument of the system doesn't work for people in the third world, as an example, or you know, wherever, not to mention a huge portion of the US is underbanked or unbanked. But I also think you could give, maybe if he's more of a technologist, like, dude, do you really think this system, like, is JP Morgan, the AIs, are they really going to wait ACH transfers? Are they really going to be trying to plug in Swift and deal with all that? Absolutely. There's no chance.
Yeah.
That question also makes me think about the blog post from 2020, August 21st in the year 2020, called "Why the Yuppie Elite Dismiss Bitcoin." And this is by Jesse. He was a NIM at the time, but he's come out publicly now. But really good post. Highly recommended. There's one chart in particular that I share with people, because so often you come across someone who's highly intelligent, very accomplished in their career, and they say super dumb things about Bitcoin. They clearly do not understand it. So like a natural reaction from some people is like, oh, they're stupid. It's like, well, no, I don't think that they're dumb. There's a lot of smart people in many other realms that just don't get it. So then it's like, well, maybe they don't have spent enough time, and there could be a bunch of reasons. But what this blog post really focuses and hones in on is it's a two-dimensional graph, and on the y-axis is IQ, but on the x-axis is trust in the system. And that's the critical ingredients. High, because this guy, Jesse, went to, I think it was Stanford, got a Stanford MBA, and he's with a bunch of other like smart Stanford MBAs, many of whom didn't then and maybe still don't really get into Bitcoin. Oh, great. Thank you for joining us. Go down to the next graph.
Yep. There you go.
Yep. Perfect. So like his, you know, MBA buddies are in the upper right hand corner. They both are smart and they trust the system. So they are the least likely to get Bitcoin. Whereas on the left-hand side, people who don't trust the system, and you definitely encounter this with a lot of people in Bitcoin, they are, you know, anti-authority and sort of adversarial mindset is very common when you encounter a person in Bitcoin, independent of their IQ. And so I think that's why on the left-hand side of this graph, you're much more likely to understand Bitcoin, become a Bitcoiner, invest in it, work on it, champion it. So I really like this graph. Now, is it helpful to show this to someone who's in the upper right hand quadrant? I don't think so. There still needs to be, maybe for some people who are really good at being self-aware, they could look at this and then realize maybe that's where they're at. And that's why there's like this natural blocker for them as to why they're not getting Bitcoin. But, you know, I think we need to find other ways to create educational material and ways, narratives and stories and ways to explain Bitcoin to reach all kinds of different people, including people in the upper right-hand quadrant of this graph.
And I'm trying to digest the legend here. It says, orange is propensity for Bitcoin maximalism, and blue is propensity for Bitcoin moonism. So does that mean blue is people thinking it will go up, but they don't otherwise care about it as a unique asset?
Yeah, I mean, I can read it here. And my recollection is like moonism is like number go up without much thought beyond that.
Got it.
Like less understanding of how Bitcoin works, whereas like maximalism or the upper left-hand quadrant is more akin to like, David, your explanation for why you're into Bitcoin, you know?
Yeah. But I admit too that like the, you know, the blue kind of caught my eye initially, right? So it is a powerful marketing agent. I wonder, Steve, you sort of point out that upper right quadrant and talked about MBAs. I think you have an MBA. How do you feel like
I don't
you,
like to promote that though.
He's got his LinkedIn locked down. But I was going to ask, like, do you feel like you were, like, my guess is you would have become more adversarial minded over time from having sort of digested all of this. But do you feel like you started pretty adversarial minded and unlike your cohort of maybe, you know, your MBA class? Like, did you feel a bit like an outsider, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think I've always been of that mindset. Maybe it has more to do with growing up in a small town in Iowa and just sort of like that exposure to that. It was very different than living in the Bay Area and going to Berkeley and things like that. So given that upbringing, maybe that, or I was just born with it, I don't know. But I'd say I've always kind of had a chip on my shoulder, anti-authoritarian, long before business school. But I'm able to blend all these different worlds.
And then did you get more extreme in that direction the deeper you got into Bitcoin, or are you just sort of, you like were that way and you've kind of maintained that? That's like why you were attracted in the beginning.
It's certainly an ingredient in my attraction, but again, it's not, I mean, I don't think it's fair to say, or even like a good reason to be into Bitcoin just because you're against authority. I mean, I'm into Bitcoin for the reasons I said earlier, which is I worry about the future, digital money, always having a middleman. That is the essence of why I work on Bitcoin, but I do have a distrust of highly centralized systems in society. So that's why I think Bitcoin's a really unique, interesting solution to this problem.
Yeah, I also just wanted to plus one on this. I think this is one of probably the five best articles I've ever read about Bitcoin, certainly sociologically. And I remember when I read this in 2020 as well, I also had just like a eureka moment. And I did share this with a bunch of my friends, interestingly enough. And I also have kind of an interesting background on this where I grew up also in the South and my parents were certainly more out there, more, let's say, hippie types, listening to all kinds of conspiracy type radio shows and things like that. Not like right wing, but more like coast to coast. If you guys know what that is, UFOs, that sort of stuff. So I always had a very open mind. Then, you know, I went to one of the most sort of elitist type schools you could possibly go to. And that was a brand new world. And to this day, my friends, you know, I went to Yale. So my friends at Yale, like only guys that get Bitcoin from there still are the ones that either went into sort of Peter Thiel orbit or went into hedge funds. That's it. Still. And all my friends that went all of the sort of mainstream routes, of course, these people are smart, that same sort of thing. Still, maybe some of them are starting to wake up at this last bull run, but they, like, this article hit the nail right on the head. Just cannot understand, like, hey, the system that we played so hard to sort of optimize and maximize for, maybe that system is itself inherently just rigged. And to your point, Steve, I didn't necessarily send it to the ones that are in that sort of camp because that's not going to do great things, but I sent it to my friends that are sort of in the hedge fund world. Okay, this is 120% what happened. Meanwhile, my friends in Mexico, where I lived for many years, are on the complete other end of the spectrum. You know, some no school or like very whatever, not into that, into art, into music, and completely don't trust the system. Without going too deep in this, I think about zero of my friends in Mexico got vaccines as an example. And so all of them grok Bitcoin immediately in 2017. I'm not saying you should be anti-vax or like that's exactly the way it works, but it was very interesting for me to see 100% of my friends in Mexico got it immediately back in 2017 and have still been into it. And with the exception of like three or four people I mentioned, none of my friends were. So I think this essay was just so small.
And do you feel like that you've had any transition, Max? Or like you started kind of without their ideas and you've kind of been pretty consistent on that, or you've gotten sort of more extreme adversarial minded or sort of, you know, sort of more skepticism of the system over time?
You know, it's funny. I think I definitely, the deeper you go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, I got more paranoid, more extreme, all of those things, of course. Like, how could you not? The more you start seeing. And I would actually say maybe in the last year or two, maybe come a little bit around. I know we're not going to talk about all the custody stuff today, but in some ways, I feel like I went way deep into like everyone should be like self-custodying, moving off the grid and all this, into maybe swinging back a little bit more neutral and saying, you know, even though a lot of institutions are corrupt, it's not necessarily that like people are super evil or that everything in the world's going to end tomorrow and everything bad's going to happen. Like, institutions are great. Working together is absolutely great. And I think that it's like there's healthy middle grounds, I would say. Like, I'm a big fan, for example, of River doing their proof of reserves. I think that's like, okay, this is you know, it's a bank and you have to trust them as a bank, but they're also like taking a huge step, which is much better than the last banking system. So in some ways, it's interesting. I feel like I kind of reached peak skepticism of the system right after COVID for a variety of reasons. You know, I wonder what those could be. But maybe I'm a little bit more moderate now than I used to be.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to riff on one thing you said, Max, about the proof of reserves. And earlier we talked about January 3rd. It's like Bitcoin's birthday for the Genesis block. Well, one thing that a group of Bitcoiners have made January 3rd as well as a tradition every year is proof of keys. And so like the idea is that everyone or as many people as possible should withdraw their coins from the exchange or custodian where they keep their coins if they don't already self-custody. Effectively, like it, I mean, you could also call it a bank run day, right? Like with dollars, it'd be like everyone lining up and trying to withdraw actual cash. And of course that breaks because of the fractional reserve system. But with Bitcoin, anyone holding your Bitcoin should have a full reserve. So there's kind of a proof that they really do have a full reserve. Now, what Max mentioned is River has a sophisticated technique to prove that the Bitcoin assets they have on chain, that it matches their Bitcoin liabilities for their customers. And it's a pretty elaborate system, and it's way better than nothing. And it is what it doesn't capture, and no system could possibly capture, is liabilities that a company has that aren't related to the blockchain or the Bitcoin blockchain. So it's not foolproof, but certainly the existence of it and a company that is willing to put resources behind it to make that happen certainly earns some trust, I think, relative to others that don't. And hopefully more and more banks do that. But another way you can do that is simply withdraw your Bitcoin. Even if you want to keep your Bitcoin with River or Coinbase or whomever, withdrawing it and then you can redeposit it, it does prove to yourself and in some sense prove to everyone that they had the Bitcoin, because if enough people do that, it could expose some bad actors. So that's one thing that people have made January 3rd.
We don't have to get into all the details, because I'm sure it's a bit complicated, but I've seen Alex tweet about this proof of reserves thing, but I don't know much about how it actually works. So have they taken like some well-known addresses, and those are sort of, how do they match that up with their customer accounts, or how do they prove what is proven, or what should we be looking for there?
Yeah, well, I think so that it's easy to prove that you have the, you know, X amount of Bitcoin. You can show a public address and how much Bitcoin is there, and then you can sign a message with the private key for that public address. So you don't have to reveal your private key. You don't even have to move the money. But if you just sign a message, some kind of unique message, that's relatively straightforward. That proves you have X amount of Bitcoin. But how does everyone know what your Bitcoin liabilities are?
That's just signing a message and you can publish it anywhere. It doesn't live on the Bitcoin blockchain. It's just signed with the private keys that control those addresses.
Yeah. So that's relatively easy to do and straightforward. The harder part is the liability side. And you're going to test my memory on getting all the details right. But so I'll sort of like hand wave it a little bit. But it does, at least, I mean, there's different techniques. This technique I'm recalling, it does require some subset of your customers actually using the tools that are provided by, in this case, River. I believe they create like a Merkle tree of all their customers' amounts, individual amounts, and that you can do so in a privacy-preserving way. Like it doesn't have like, you know, David King X and Max Webster Y. It just has in this tree. And then the tool that a customer can use is that there's some way you can find your amount in the tree. And I forget the exact technique to make sure that's not conflicting with other people, but it somehow uniquely identifies you. You can uniquely identify your amount, your balance is in that tree. And so if I guess like a log N number of customers do it, at least if it's sort of evenly distributed, then that would be enough proof that the whole tree is accurate. And even just like having a small percentage of the customers do it some, it would greatly reduce the risk that this tree was fraudulent in some way.
All right. Is this related to, or I seem to recall that Zappo back in the day had some feature that I think it would either show you like the address of the coin that you had purchased and they were custodying for you, or the UTXO or something?
Well, yeah. So the difference with Zappo is that they segregated funds. So each customer had their own on-chain balance. And so they provided that customer with the public address. So you could literally see all your personal transactions going on and off the chain. That was if you put it in the Zappo vault. So if you segregate funds, that's a relatively simple way to do it. Of course, that has scaling issues and efficiency issues. So the first technique we talked about with like what River has done with this Merkle tree, that's if you have a custodian that commingles everyone's funds into a single wallet.
And you would do that not out of malice, but just out of efficiency because there's cost to move things on chain. Whereas if you have it all in a single wallet, they're kind of IOUs anyways, you can do that very efficient transfers if they don't move interrupts, right?
That's correct.
That'd be super expensive to have a UTXO grammar. Great.
All right.
But what are the scaling? Because we had actually touched on these interest in sort of like some of how broadly based can self-custody be and what are sort of the scaling limitations. Can we get a little bit of just an overview of what are the limitations? Can everybody in the world own a UTXO? I think the answer is no, but can we talk to like why that's the case?
Sure. On average, every 10 minutes, a new Bitcoin block is produced, which is just a collection of transactions. Right now, something around 3,000 transactions are in a typical block. But a transaction can actually have multiple outputs. So, for example, I can create one transaction that pays both of you, or even a transaction that pays 10,000 different recipients. The actual relevant number, I think, is the number of outputs or UTXOs, unspent transaction outputs. So how many UTXOs or outputs can you fit in a block? It's around 10,000. I think the theoretical limit is around 20,000, but let's call it 10,000. I think that's a realistic limit would be 10,000, but whatever it is, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, there's a limit to how many outputs recipients you can have every 10 minutes. And I forget the exact math, but you know, there's like 52,000 blocks in a year. And so if it's 10,000 outputs per block, if we're able to reach that level of efficiency, then it's something like 500 million outputs per year. So, you know, well, that's 500 million humans that could receive one UTXO per year. So you could go, 20 years? 20 years, then you reach the population, but then you throw in AI and other stuff, let alone the fact that most people's usage of Bitcoin, sorry, applications, they would want to do more than one every 20 years. Even if you're like strongest diamond hands hodler, you know, you might want to do one transaction, more frequently than every 20 years. So that's probably the most important fundamental scaling factor is that.
And given those limitations, does it mean that we should conclude that, you know, many people in the world should get comfortable trusting third-party custodians, or something to do with eCash can help us solve this? Or is there any sort of prescriptive, like, what to do about this? Or is it still kind of just a hotly debated topic?
Well, certainly debated. I mean, it's been debated for a long, long time, right? I mean, the scaling wars of like 2015 to 2017, in which Bitcoin Cash ended up splitting off, often framed as big blockers versus small blockers. That was a very heated debate about this exact subject. Because clearly one way to address the scaling issue that I just mentioned is if you make the blocks bigger, you can fit more than 10,000 outputs in a block. You could fit 10 times more, 1,000 more, a million more. So, and that's like a one line code change, super simple to do. Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV have already done it. But there's a reason there's a heated debate. There's serious trade-offs with that, which I won't get into because that's a whole episode in and of itself. And there's been books written about it, et cetera. And even today, you know, they're like one of the hottest topics right now in technical world in Bitcoin is covenants and like, more generally, like how to scale Bitcoin. There's like at least 10 different covenant techniques. And with covenants, they may offer a way to scale Bitcoin. Proponents certainly think so. My own observations, though, I would say at a high level, this is an unsolved R&D problem, like not just in Bitcoin, but in the world. Any cryptocurrency, including Bitcoin, doesn't matter which scaling project you're a fan of, none of them actually are a silver bullet that solves the problem, that brings this to every human being able to do multiple payments per day, use it as a currency, and get all the properties that on-chain Bitcoin provides you, that does not exist.
What is your intuition? I mean, I know this is completely unsolved. For context, for anyone listening, the covenants, like, there's different ways you do things, like channel factors, multiple Lightning channels at once, research rollups, there's Arc, which is something I don't understand well enough to go deep on, but there's all these different ways you could potentially scale what we have at Lightning today. Then there's, on top of that, there's eCash stuff, which eCash is a non-custodial but private and very easy to way use for people to use Bitcoin. That's already today. Advocates of Cali there saying maybe we get some of these project more silver bullets or lots of buckshot coming at more technical base layer scaling solutions. But we know with things like eCash, we get scaled fully today. And then there's just like this sort of simple left side of the curve. Now, most people are going to use like custodial services from River Block and like 10 other companies. And like, it is what it is because they'll be able to move between them and it's interoperable. So be it. What is your best intuition 10 years out on what actually ends up happening?
Well, yeah. I mean, let me just first say, you mentioned a number of different solutions, most of which I'm an advocate for, or at least I'm really happy that those experiments are playing out. All of them have trade-offs. And the trade-offs are typically like trust, like how much, if the more you trust someone else or a group of people, then you get wins on like lower fees or it works faster or it's simpler, things like that. The UX is better. And the more you want to reduce trust, usually you have to give on some of those other aspects. Yeah. I mean, I don't see, obviously everyone hopes that there's a silver bullet solution so that we should all hope for that. I don't see that on the radar though. So I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying I don't see even the seed of that. So in 10 years, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we still don't have a silver bullet solution. What we do have after 10 years is a subset of the things that are being worked on today have matured and have found real use cases and real users and are used substantially, none of which are silver bullets, but they solve specific use cases well. Some of them that are being developed today will just, you know, die off and were maybe good efforts, but didn't really find success. And there'll be many more innovations we haven't even thought of yet over the next 10 years that'll be sort of in the same boat. Some will die off, some will succeed with specific use cases. And then so in 10 years, what we'll have is like, we'll have several different types of systems used where people are, but the commonality between all these systems are Bitcoin is money and people are sending and receiving Bitcoin. And all these systems are interoperable with each other. And they're interoperable not only at the base chain layer of Bitcoin, but at the Lightning Network. And the Lightning Network ties all these together. So I'm quite confident that is all of that will exist in 10 years. We can all cross our fingers and hope that there is some silver bullet emerges, which simplifies all that. But I think that we shouldn't bank on that for sure. We should definitely encourage engineers and really smart thinkers to explore that. But people building tools and applications shouldn't bank on that app.
Do you think that there's a kind of a, you know, oftentimes with the new technologies, there's kind of like a infrastructure application, kind of a yin and yang, a push and pull or back and forth. Like you need enough infrastructure to be able to build the apps you want, but you need apps that drive demand for better infrastructure. And there's sort of like a push and pull to those. Do you think that maybe this ecosystem is held back by not having enough great use cases yet in payments? Or do you think that like there's enough use cases and we're sort of limited by the infrastructure, the technology choices?
I definitely don't think we have enough use cases. And it also depends. I mean, there's different flavors of that. Do we have enough use cases of censorship, censored money use cases? I don't think so. If there were, like, then Bitcoin should be used. And if Bitcoin's not used there, what's the problem? What's limiting them is the UX or something else. But even like using custodial Bitcoin, like a trusted system that is your wallet, we need more use cases for that as well. So we definitely need more use cases. Having said that, if we all of a sudden had use cases and tremendous demand, millions of people want to use Bitcoin every day. That would drive R&D investment to find, you know, to improve self-custody solutions, but it's not going to just instantly deliver that. That demand would largely be met with like custodial Bitcoin payments. Like if 2025, some killer app came out like if Tinder adds Bitcoin or something, and then all of a sudden, like, there's millions and millions of payments every hour, and that's going to be custodial Bitcoin supporting that until some future point. It could be eCash. Like, eCash is custodial, so it could be eCash, for example.
Right. But like Stacker News, for example, was fully custodial, and I think they've transitioned to fully non-custodial. Is that true?
Yeah, literally today.
As of today? Okay. So they've kind of gone through this transition. I think, Kian's done a great job, very forward-thinking entrepreneur and founder in the space. I think they have like some amount of product market fit, but certainly like hasn't sort of taken over the world yet. So I almost wonder, it seems like he hasn't been held back by the custodial versus non-custodial split or sort of the change, but maybe there are kind of edgier use cases that would be held back by that, especially, I think we don't always like to, we always like sort of imagine the lofty ideals, but a lot of times new technologies get into people's hands because of like adult or gambling use cases. And so are there adult or gambling use cases? Maybe they look a little unsavory on the surface, but are there, is there a lot of innovation going on in that area with Bitcoin? I haven't personally run across a lot of it. It feels like a lot of the really scammy stuff happens.
I think you should share your own research on that.
For next, you'll have to close it.
But there's one thing, like, for example, I don't know if you guys ever read Fred Wilson's blog, Fred Wilson from USV, kind of a notable venture capitalist. He wrote, used to be notable. Okay. Or used to read it. But he did a 2025 predictions. And one of his predictions was, he predicted there'd be some sort of like a TikTok like video consumption experience to launch meme coins, something that kind of like, when I hear that, I'm like none of that sounds that good to me, but it does seem like the kind of thing where a internet native currency or digital payment use case could really explode and could be explosive. If somebody starts making a bunch of money for uploading a funny video or making a funny meme, it seems like that kind of thing could drive a lot of demand for usage, whether that's custodial or non-custodial. So I feel like we need a little bit of these, what we might on the surface consider a little unsavory, like meme coins, I don't want to be involved with that stuff. But it's like maybe some of that, the coin itself may be trash, but if the payment is initiated and settled with Bitcoin Lightning, maybe that's actually something that would drive a lot of kind of use case or adoption.
Definitely. And I can't speak to those specific fields. And I'm actually surprised more hasn't happened there yet. Maybe this is also kind of this place to be in transition to some of our predictions. But I think one thing that I know we've been chatting about for a future episode is just Noster season 3. We don't have time to get to it. It's so much happening. But I think I posted like 10 links for you guys of just new projects that I've discovered in the last couple of days on Noster. The amount of energy happening right now in Noster is absolutely incredible. And I think you're going to see some killer apps this year. I've seen at least 3 different people discussing, 2 with actual code, 3rd from someone very credible, attempts at building more Instagram or TikTok-like experiences on Noster with payments. I was discussing with Million as well. I think the really key breakout for brand or something like that is going to be when you can show like a tier content creator, not like what someone's doing, but that's able to say, I made 10x more or beyond Noster with Bitcoin payments, as whatever, a TikToker or Substacker, whatever the medium is. And I, can now pay my rent and do this full time. I think that's going to be the magic moment. I also think that people are going to be shocked at how attractive it is to see, I got those payments. If you can show in real time, whatever, I made, 20K doing this crazy breakout video. Oh my God, I pulled that for 6 months. Now it's 300K. What happened there? So I do think we're starting to see a lot of that bubble up. But if you guys are game, cool if we do some predictions?
Yep, prediction time.
All right.
Yeah. And I see Jesse sharing predicts has a prediction market on Lightning. So I haven't seen it yet, but I want to play with that one. Thanks for sharing, Jesse.
So this is great. I'm going to throw a couple out. These are not these are sort of directional, but Jesse's already kind of getting to one of my things. So I think we're going to see this year, we're going to see multiple breakout Lightning Network applications that use the Lightning Network. Breakout meaning, millions of dollars flowing through the Middle East. And I think that one of them that I was going to mention is a strong possibility is a prediction market. And to your point, if you can find other areas on the internet where there's been clear product market fit or demand for a service and they use a shitcoin, it's like the coin's completely unnecessary, Polygon or whatever they're using, I guess USDC or something like that. But if you if you can find one of those examples and all you need is just payments and money and add Bitcoin Lightning, I think all of those are going to benefit you not only from cap, but also from the price of Bitcoin skyrocketing this year. So a few possibilities in the throughout prediction market is certainly, I think you're going to see multiple Nostra apps that are doing, you know, millions of dollars of payments flow through them in some way. I think candidates like Primal and Amethyst and Will's browser, you know, certainly for some of the mainstream stuff. But I think there's going to be at least one, probably several brand new experiences that pop that surprise people. I think, again, one of the major driving forces behind both of those is going to be people saying, holy shit, this is the best environment for me to come. And basically on the tails of the Bitcoin market, you know, we talked about some price predictions last week. I think I was too bearish the more I thought about it. So if Bitcoin rips over
too bearish with your 420.
Yeah, I think when Bitcoin rips 500K, people are going to lose their minds, and they're going to lose their minds. It's not going to be all the way up, obviously, it'll chop, but I think that's going to draw a lot of attention into some of these new experiences. So prediction market is one strong possibility. I think new Nostra experiences, the current ones are going to continue growing, and there'll be at least one new breakout experience.
Nostra.
On top of that, I think you're going to see perhaps the biggest application with Bitcoin Lightning Network this year be something with AI. I don't know exactly what it's going to be, but my prediction there is you're going to see the first AI multimillionaire denominate their Bitcoin. We've already seen this like Ngozi Gnosis or whatever thing, but again, with the shitcoin, completely unnecessary. I think you're going to see the first AI agent that makes several million dollars in Bitcoin, probably using Lightning Network. And I don't know what that business model is going to be. It could even be something unsavory, but I think that's going to. Additionally, some other sort of spicy predictions. I think Twitter X will integrate Lightning mainstream this year. And I think you're going to see real payment volume happen there. That could be maybe the biggest breakout app. I also think you're going to see, I don't know how this is going to manifest itself. And I think Elon's going to borrow some of these primitives, but I think you're going to see maybe through an app or maybe just like through developers to understand that perhaps the biggest short-term value of Nostra besides the socioeconomic landscape of making everything a payable endpoint is the authenticity. I think AI agents and deepfakes and all that stuff is going to be way worse than we ever imagined. And Nostra is going to emerge as we're going to begin to see a safe internet where you know things have web trust scores, are from humans you know and trust, and it's the only place in the internet that can do that. Maybe Twitter X will as well, but of course that will require trust. So those are some of my predictions.
Cool.
David.
All right. Are you still thinking about yours?
No.
I've got some.
All right.
I mean, the one that I was going to mention, which I guess it sort of touches on some of the themes that Max was touching on, but I would say simply, we will have somebody who gains celebrity for having earned a substantial amount of Bitcoin. And today we have people who are celebrities for talking about Bitcoin, for mining Bitcoin, building businesses, et cetera, you know, or just holding for a long time. But I think something, whether it's a human or an agent or somebody who makes a great video or somebody who shares something and gains celebrity because of how much Bitcoin they're paid for that thing. And I think like maybe like that, you know, that Truth Terminal, like an AI agent thing that I don't know too much about. I haven't followed it closely, but you shared one with me the other.
Same one, no?
What is it called?
Ngozi of Gnosis. I recommend not Google, but I believe it.
I know enough not to search for Ngozi. I don't know. There's two things, but then there was one Steve shared. I thought it was AI X Grant or something, or I forget what it was.
It replied to Ren's question. Ren asked a question of it, and then it replied the answer.
And is it involved in some sort of Bitcoin related thing, or it's just some sort of an AI agent that replies?
Looks like a, I don't know. I mean, look to me like, okay, a crypto AI.
But I think that concept, we should see that either that in Bitcoin or somebody creating something great and getting paid and gaining some sort of status or celebrity from having done that in kind of a Bitcoin centric way. So I think that's one thing. The other one, and I don't wish this, but I kind of feel like a little bit I feel like we're a little bit of on a crash course of the U.S. government co-opting something that we otherwise see as more independent or private property. And I think that's going to happen because I think Bitcoin's becoming a little almost like too important to the government and future of currency and money and stuff. Whether that's like some of the Tether relationship becomes more overt, or there's some action taken with a stablecoin censorship, or, you know, the one I was chatting with a friend this morning, which I won't predict is going to happen in 2025. At some point, if MicroStrategy acquires enough Bitcoin, maybe it becomes like the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, take private, take public, take ownership by the U.S. government, because it's sort of like strategically important in a way. And I don't wish that. I hope it doesn't happen. And I don't predict exactly which of these paths, but I think something of that flavor of like Bitcoin gaining a little too much importance, that the U.S. government does something that maybe doesn't quite co-opt it in some way, that maybe a little unsavory to us, self-custody plebs.
I would solicit you add a chapter to the BCAP project, Bitcoin Consensus Analysis, on this hypothesis.
Meaning to see if, to sort of battle test it against the other stakeholders?
You can, yeah, you open up a PR and add your, like an actual scenario. Actual scenario, yeah.
Don't be so excited, DK.
Well, I mean, a couple of things, just, you know, for relevant news, like there was, you know, MicroStrategy in particular, I think he just added a guy from like the FDIC to the board or something, some guy who's obviously very connected in politics. And then I think yesterday, Saylor was sharing a tweet that he's hanging out at Mar-a-Lago with, what's his name, Eric Trump, the son of the guy who's kind of super pro-Bitcoin in the Trump family. So in a sense, he's kind of saying like, we're close, we're buddies, we're doing that thing, you know, which is fine. I get that's how the world works. But I think it's an indication of that cozying up or tightening relationship that could be concerning for the decentralized nature.
So I just want to add one or two things on that. I 100% agree with you. And my kind of mental model moving forward is that MicroStrategy is the strategic reserve. Maybe there'll be a separate one as well. But like, I definitely think MicroStrategy is going to get nationalized. I don't think it happens in 2025. I could be wrong. That's a weird one. As a similar, since it's kind of like later, I don't want this to happen, but I just have a feeling that it's not going to be in 2025, but like the next big pullback, I don't necessarily agree with people. It's like, oh, we'll never get a pullback again or whatever. And I think that's why it's so important, as we discussed in earlier episodes, that we diversify custody. I do think Coinbase will get hacked at some point. I don't think it's going to be this year, but at some point.
A disaster. Right. Are you ready?
Steve, we only have a few minutes. Just price prediction, and then we'll wrap it.
I gotta rattle them off. By the way, I hate giving price predictions, but I was asked at that gathering in November 19th what it would be at the end of the year, and I said 98K, and it's 98K right now. I don't know what it was actually on New Year's Eve. That wasn't so bad. Anyway, okay, here are my 2025 predictions. The first is kind of consistent with Max's, like, Lightning's going to... We're going to see some explosiveness there, but I River came out with a report in August of 2023, like, you know, saying that Lightning grew 1,212% the past 2 years or something. I think River will come out with another report this year on Lightning, and we're going to see similar types of growth. Like, we're going to see consistent growth, meaning continued explosive growth. That's one prediction. Two, we've talked a little bit about mining on this show, but I think we will see a major mining pool adopt Stratum V2, which is a new mining protocol, which really helps with the decentralization of mining. Currently, there are no mining pools to support it. My prediction is a major mining pool will add support for Stratum V2 in 2025.
And you have no inside knowledge about that. He's making a prediction.
Insider trading. Where's the truth? No politics.
I don't control such decisions.
Yep. Very nice.
Here's a spicy one. So there will be no consensus rule changes to Bitcoin in 2025, despite others claiming that there would be some last year. And I still don't think there'll be any in 2025. corollary to that, I think the next consensus rules change to Bitcoin will be the Great Consensus Cleanup, which is just a bundle of bug fixes. And it's being actively developed right now. But I think realistically, that wouldn't get activated until 2026. I think there needs to be at least a year after all the coding's done and like the specs done and the tests are done and then shared more broadly for it to realistically be activated. So I think that's a 2026.
And is that, I've heard Matt talk about that on podcasts, and I think you and Matt maybe talked about Great Consensus Cleanup. Is that you and your team and Matt who are mostly working on that, or is there a bunch of people outside who are doing that? Or?
Matt Carollo proposed it almost 6 years ago, like fixes. Like the known bugs in Bitcoin consensus or in vulnerabilities, security vulnerabilities have been known for like a decade or so. Matt proposed fixes to five of them 6 years ago, then didn't really pursue that, and no one worked on it for 5 years. I tweeted about it a year ago, sort of just reminding people, but also 95% of people in Bitcoin weren't even around then. And even the people who were around then had never heard of it. So like the awareness level of these changes are very low because they're bug fixes, right? But they're super important. So I tweeted about it. Then I learned that there's another developer who had recently, started exploring it. His name's Antoine Poinsot, and he's a Bitcoin Core developer. And he's the one now that is largely focused on really nailing down every last detail of how to fix this. Because fixing these types of things, anytime you're changing consensus or like trying to fix it, the last thing you want to do is like introduce new problems. So it's not as easy as just like finding it off by one bug and then fixing it the same day and pushing out like other software projects. This requires like months and months and months research to really make sure that it's a solid fix. So he's focused on that right now. And he's also done, I think, one or two shows, and he's discussing the change and Delving Bitcoin as a developer forum where he's posted a lot of details for this. Okay, we're a little over. I have two more predictions.
Yeah.
Predictions. So another one is that I expect several major Bitcoin brands to adopt Bolt 12 in 2025, which for those that don't know what Bolt 12 is, it's a new payment protocol within Bitcoin that fixes a bunch of problems with existing payment protocols in Bitcoin. The challenge with such adoption, though, is just like any standard, like a new Bluetooth standard or any kind of standard where you have interoperability between phones or applications, it requires a long time to get broad adoption. But I think major brands will adopt it in 2025, and that'll really put it, flip it from like early adopters adopting it to like sort of a sentiment of like, oh my God, you don't support it yet. So I think we'll see that psychological shift in 2025. And my last prediction, which I think Max called for crazy predictions. None of what I said is crazy, but here's a bit of a crazy prediction. So I think there will be, in the bull market of 2025, things will get out of hand. There'll be increased M&A activity. And I can imagine several big tech companies acquiring Bitcoin companies, but the one I'll put out there is Meta will buy Lightspark.
Yeah, I can see that.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my crazy 2025 prediction, is Meta acquiring Lightspark. David,
that's a bold
Marcus
one.
David will find his home again at Facebook.
Yeah, it's a bold one I haven't heard discussed.
I hope there's so much M&A activity we can't even imagine.
All right. Well, if any of that happens, I'm sure we'll be talking about it. So tune in next Friday at noon Pacific.
One last follow-up question. Do you think, obviously, there's a strong relationship there. That's a great prediction. Do you think that if this bull run gets crazy, all of the big tech companies are going to feel like, shit, we need to acquire at the very least some of these really good teams to start working on this?
I definitely think that. I think there's some big tech companies that are maybe more forward thinking at this point, and then others will just want to fast follow. They get nervous. And sadly, at like DK, my former company, Google, is like in the latter camp. I do know that like when there were rumors of Facebook doing Libra before it was known, it was just a rumor. I had made all these attempts at Google to tell them about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and that they should start something like Spiral. This is long before Spiral existed. This is like back in 2017, 2018. And it fell on deaf ears. But as soon as the rumors came out that Facebook was doing something, then everyone at Google, all the executives were reaching out to me saying, like, what should we do? Right. So I think we could see, you know, and these days, Microsoft is more forward thinking than other big tech companies. So I could see Microsoft or Meta making a big move and then all of a sudden fast followers from Google and other big tech companies.
And Max, as the venture investor, like, give me who's got the corp dev contact? Yeah, so if you need to acquire a talented team, ask
you're
Max.
You're one of the Magnificent Seven interested in acquiring the best Bitcoin talent on the planet. Drop in the chat.
All right. Well, with that, we'll wrap for today then.
All right. Bye, guys.
See you, everyone. Bye-bye.